Welcome to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. The death toll from Superstorm Sandy is now at least 55 people along the Atlantic coast. Communities throughout the eastern seaboard and mid-Atlantic states are slowly recovering from the storm. Hundreds of thousands in New York City alone are still without electricity, but buses are running again. Some airports have reopened, and Wall Street is trading again after a two-day shutdown. While the impact on the Midwest is significantly less, we have felt Sandy's effects, and not just in terms of wind. Loved ones are stranded, and folks from the two-state region are headed to or in the states affected and looking for ways to help out. While we all continue to monitor the damage caused by Sandy, we thought you might like an opportunity to understand a bit deeper exactly what happened to cause this superstorm. So, on today's Focus, we'll examine the storm itself with the help of two guests. Meteorologist Ed Kieser, of course, was the chief meteorologist here at WILL for many years. These days, he is based in Columbus, Ohio, and he spent the last several days monitoring and offering analysis of Superstorm Sandy. Ed Kieser, welcome to Focus.
My pleasure. Great to be back with you.
Yeah, good to be on the air with you again. Also with us is Jim Angel, Illinois State climatologist based at the Illinois State Water Survey here on the U of I campus. Jim, welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And for the first part of the program, we are also joined by Kelly Formoso, volunteer and youth coordinator for the American Red Cross in Champaign. Kelly, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
As we begin our discussion, we welcome your questions and comments at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu, and we also welcome your questions on our Facebook page. You can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is Will Public Media. Jim and Ed, stand by for just a couple of minutes here. I want to start with Kelly, who will only be able to join us for the first part of today's program. Kelly, what efforts are taking place here in Champaign-Urbana and surrounding communities to support those dealing with the aftermath of Superstorm Sandy?
Well, we are sending volunteers out. Before the storm hit, we had two volunteers sent. They're helping with mapping and mass care effort. We plan to send more individuals out. You know, luckily JFK is opening. That's a good sign for us that we can send more volunteers. But we have about 1,700 disaster relief volunteers out there currently. What we're asking for our local community is to give blood. Nearly 300 Red Cross blood drives have already been canceled due to the storm and more expected. This represents a loss of as many as 9,000 blood and platelet products. We're asking people who are eligible to give blood, especially in places not affected by the storm, like Central Illinois.
Well, okay, so explain that. Why is it that you're finding that there's a specific need for blood here as a result of the storm there?
So since those blood drives have been canceled, Central Illinois is going to be one of the places that will export blood. So once we fulfill our requirements at our hospitals we serve here, we will then send blood to the East Coast to help essentially with the hospitals there, you know, to make sure that patients have the blood if they have surgeries, accidents, cancer patients. There's a great need.
Right. And then I guess also there are other, you know, community blood banks and that sort of thing here in the region, but they don't necessarily send blood to the East Coast, right?
With the American Red Cross, we're national. So the Red Cross here is the same Red Cross we have in New York, same Red Cross we have in Maine. So we can easily facilitate the movement of our blood there, and their national contracts. So it's our job to fulfill them. So we'd be one of the first places they'd call.
I was mentioning off-air the fact that, you know, one of the things we want to talk about during this hour is the impact that the storm has had here in the Midwest. And in one way that it's been impacted is that there are people here who have family and friends in New York and New Jersey or, you know, in other areas that, of course, that are stranded or dealing with power outages. And you're actually one of those folks.
I am. My parents live in upstate New York, about an hour away from the city. And then my sister lives in Manhattan and most of my friends. So, you know, going through the storm with them, I had my family have one cell phone on at all times so I could connect with them, turn off all the others. We didn't know when we were going to get power. With my parents, yesterday they were told they could be out for 12 days. And then in Manhattan, where my sister lives, they're still out and they're being asked to go to work. It's just a lot of stress right now for those individuals.
And if you're dealing with something similar, we welcome those stories this morning at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. 9455. Also, I understand you were in New York when Hurricane Irene hit a little over a year ago.
Yes. And, you know, Irene was a much different storm. In my area, we had roads shut down. New Jersey Transit didn't open until January. So, we have a lot of commuters in my town. And so to get to New York City was very difficult. And we're going to see the same issues. Every line of New Jersey Transit has been affected with major damage. So that will be interesting to see what comes of that. The one thing I did want to mention is if you do have family or loved ones in the affected areas and you haven't been able to reach them, we have a site called Red Cross Safe and Well website. You can register and visit www.redcross.org or call 1-800-RED-CROSS. And what you can do is search for your family in shelters. You just need their name and a phone number or their name and their pre-disaster address, and you can see if they've been our Red Cross shelter. We had 9,000 people stay in our shelters last night in 171 different shelters across 13 states. So if you're concerned, please visit that website.
What else at this point can any of us do to support people affected by Superstorm Sandy, and how can maybe someone interested in volunteering for the Red Cross do so?
Perfect. You can give me a call at the Red Cross. Our number is 217-351-5861. There is a volunteer process to become a disaster relief volunteer. Right now, you'd have to fill out a volunteer application. We do extensive background check because you are working with the public. And then we have courses for you to take. Now, it depends on what you're interested in. Everyone has a specialty. They have a background. They have experience. And so we'd really like to match it up. So if you'd like to work in shelters, if you'd like to work in feeding, if you'd like to work and give direct assistance and doing client casework, you can do logistics, mapping. We have all of these available. Give me a call if you'd like, if you're interested. It's not a hard process, but it is extensive.
Kelly Formoso is volunteer and youth coordinator for the American Red Cross in Champaign. I'm sure you have lots of work to do, so we'll let you go. Kelly, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we're discussing Superstorm Sandy on today's show. Now that communities along the eastern seaboard and mid-Atlantic seek to recover from this devastating storm, we thought it would be useful to take the opportunity to answer your questions about how the storm came about. So we're talking this hour with meteorologist Ed Kieser and Illinois State climatologist Jim Angel. In addition to your questions for Ed and Jim, we welcome you to share any stories you have about how this storm has impacted you and yours. Maybe you or a friend or a loved one got stranded amid the storm. Maybe it somehow impacted you in a way that might not be immediately evident. We've heard how, for example, some area restaurants may have to spend more on seafood they purchase. So there may be a number of examples. Whatever the case may be, we hope you'll share that with us this morning. And of course, again, we welcome your weather and climate questions for Ed Kieser and Jim Angel at 333-9455. Or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL, or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Okay, Ed and Jim, let's move on to how the meteorological and climatological impacts of this storm, there's so much to talk about. Ed, it seems like we had more advance warning of this storm than usual, even for a hurricane developing out in the Atlantic. When did we first get a sense of this developing storm that it was going to be something different?
Well, some of the computer models, in particular the European model, last week, a little more than a week in advance, started to indicate that a hurricane would come up the East Coast and then turn northwestward into the mid-Atlantic states exactly as it did. And when I was seeing some of that on the models more than a week out, I thought, wow, that's interesting. If that really happened, that would be quite a system. But when you look more than a week out, you're a little skeptical, especially when all the other models have different solutions. But as we got into the latter part of last week, it was becoming clear that that was indeed what was going to happen. Some of the other models, the American models, started to show a similar path for the storm. And it really was quite extraordinary in that the storm is moving northeastward up the Atlantic coast as they typically do, but when the farther north hurricanes get, they tend to start to veer off more to the east, out to sea. So this one turning and going toward the northwest, it was quite extraordinary.
Jim, as Ed was talking about, there are these different models indicating different possibilities, and I think this is something maybe folks don't always understand, that just because we see a storm on radar doesn't mean we know exactly where it's going, right?
That's right. Yes, there are several models out there that we can look at. There's the European models, and then some in the U.S. that we can look at. And so, and like Ed said, we get different solutions to those tracks. So it's sometimes you have to monitor and decide which one you're going to go with. And sometimes they look at what they call spaghetti plots because they got multiple tracks on a graph, and you kind of see where the majority of the models are taking it. And, yeah, this one was pretty well forecasted, I would say. Like Ed said earlier, last week we were starting to see the possibility of it occurring, and then as we got into this week, it became much clearer that it was going to hit the East Coast there.
Ed, are we getting better at predicting, understanding the behavior of storms like this?
The predictions are definitely better. I can't say they're 100% and never will be, but back in 2005, Hurricane Katrina was forecast quite well several days in advance. On a Friday leading up to the storm hitting early the following week, it was pretty clear that Katrina was taking a track toward New Orleans. And with this storm, I think the forecasts were extraordinary in that it was a very unusual storm and something that we typically don't see. And the models in general handled it well, and the forecasting was handled well. And as a result, there was a lot of advance notice for emergency managers to activate and get systems in place ahead of time. So as devastating as this storm was, it could have been a whole lot worse even 10, 20 years ago just because of the lack of knowing that was coming well in advance. So we cannot stop what Mother Nature is going to do, but we can prepare for it. And certainly this was, a success in that regard, that the forecasting has gotten a lot better.
And at one point, did it go from, well, here's another potential hurricane late season, to, uh-oh, this could be a potentially devastating storm? Where was that turning point?
Well, I think it was late last week when it was clear that this system coming up the East Coast had a high probability of turning in toward the mid-Atlantic states, in particular New Jersey or that general area. And all along, this was not a major hurricane. I want to emphasize that. The wind speeds on it were in the Category 1 area, but it was still a major storm for a lot of other reasons. And what was unique about this system was the merging of this hurricane, a tropical system, with a middle-latitude cyclonic system, a extratropical storm, if you will, coming in from the west. And so there was this timing of these two systems coming together, and that's what helped this storm make that turn toward the left, toward the New Jersey coast. But I think the uh-oh moment was late last week, which was many days in advance, because it was clear that this was going to be a big storm system. Is even without the hurricane, when you have a nor'easter-type middle-latitude cyclone, you can have a large area impacted with heavy rain and wind and, of course, snow in the mountains. But when you add all that moisture from the tropical system, that's where you get your big uh-oh, and, of course, the winds that go with it as well.
Jim, why is it unusual for these two systems to converge?
Well, I think it's partly a matter of timing. You know, usually we're kind of at the tail end of the tropical storm season, and so this was a late season storm that came up through there. And so, yes, sometimes just a matter of timing. In this case, the things lined up and they were able to merge together. A lot of times, you know, early in the season, you don't have that much exciting going on in the Midwest, and but in this case, we did have that low pressure system come in together with it. So yeah, it was an interesting combination. I would also add that this is probably one of the larger storms I've seen in a long time. In that, you know, if you look at the pressure system or the pressure field around it, I mean, the effects essentially went all the way back to Illinois. You know, we had strong winds out of the north on Monday and Tuesday. We had high waves on Lake Michigan, and here in Champaign-Urbana, we had, you know, it was pretty breezy, and we also had a lot of cloudiness associated with it, and that was all from the same storm. So that covered a very large area.
And I guess one of the other things that was particularly unusual about this is that it was this low-pressure system covering so much geography. What does it mean when we're talking about a low-pressure system? What's happening?
Well, in this case, the low pressure pretty much covered the eastern half of the United States, and you have counterclockwise flow around that as the winds move around it, and the stronger the drop in the pressure, the higher those winds will be. So this one had very strong drop in pressure over distance, so that really generated some pretty strong winds along with it. So it was a very strong, a very large storm.
Ed, you mentioned that the hurricane itself was a Category 1. What are the different categories for hurricanes, and what do they represent?
Well, basically, they represent the strength of the winds, the sustained winds surrounding the eye and the eye wall, the strongest winds. And for a tropical system to become a hurricane, the wind speeds have to be 74 miles per hour or higher. And once the winds get above 155 miles per hour, that would be the high-end storm, a Category 5, and all the other categories are in between. So once you get up to Categories 3, 4, and 5, it's considered a major hurricane. And, of course, some of the notable hurricanes of the past have struck Florida and the Gulf Coastal areas have been major hurricanes. So this one, in that regard, was not major. But as Jim mentioned, the overall system, once it merged with the middle latitude storm, it was huge in size, much bigger in size than your typical hurricane. So this storm impacted a much, much greater area than most.
Jim, what implications, if any, do storms like this have about concerns over our changing climate?
Well, I think there's a couple of things going on. One is that we, in one sense, this was not a surprise in that there have been many studies done about the impact of these kinds of storms in the New York area. They've gone through these exercises before and have pointed out that New York has become more vulnerable to these kinds of events, in part just because the sea level has been rising over the last century, so they're more vulnerable in that sense. It's a little harder to say about tropical systems in general, and in this case we kind of had this hybrid system of the merging of the two. Because this one was such a rare event, it's hard to track trends in something that's rare. And also, our tropical storm records are kind of sketchy.
In what ways?
In the sense that since we've had satellites, we've done a great job because we can see every storm that forms in the Atlantic and where it goes. But you know, before satellites, before the 1960s, we had sometimes planes would fly through them in the 1940s and 50s, but we didn't have a lot of data to look at. There's many storms that formed out of the Atlantic, maybe lasted a couple of days and never saw the sight of land. So a lot of those got missed in the count. So there's kind of this artificial trend in the historical data where it looks like the numbers are really low in the 1900s, early 1900s, and really high in the last 20 or 30 years. And most of that is just the fact that we've done a better job of counting them than we used to be able to do. So our historical records are kind of, that makes it more complicated to try to detect trends that way. So right now, the latest research has pretty much concluded that we really can't draw any conclusions about long-term trends at this point. Now, there is some modeling work of future changes in tropical storm activity, and some of those do suggest that we'll see an increase in these, not only the frequency, but maybe in the intensity of these as we warm up not only the atmosphere, but also the waters in the Atlantic Ocean. So that's a real possibility. But I would say, in general, it's no surprise that this kind of an event would have such a large impact on New York. I think it was just a matter of time before it hit.
So I guess, in terms of the long-term trends, then you're saying we can't really look at the data in terms of just numbers of storms and particularly numbers of hurricanes in a given season and say, oh, there's a clear ramp up in the number year to year.
That's right. Yeah, we can't just plot the numbers and draw a line through it and draw a conclusion. It's always more complicated than that.
All right. This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and my guests are meteorologist Ed Kieser and climatologist Jim Angel. We welcome your questions for them about Superstorm Sandy, how it formed, how it's compared to other storms, questions in general about hurricanes and how they behave, what we know about them, What implications, if any, storms like this have about concerns over a changing climate. And again, we also welcome any stories that you have to share about how this storm has impacted you, your family, your friends, whether indirectly here or very directly along the eastern seaboard and the mid-Atlantic states. To join our conversation, you can call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455, or you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We also welcome questions and comments on WILL's Facebook and Twitter pages. Our Twitter handle is Will Public Media. The phone numbers again, 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. And we will go first this morning to Steve in Watseka. Steve, good morning.
Hi, good morning. I just had a quick question. I was just curious. I know a lot of the hurricanes or all of the hurricanes come out of the tropics, maybe off the coast of Africa and come up from the Caribbean. But I was wondering, how come the West Coast, unless maybe I misunderstand, how come the West Coast hardly ever gets any hurricanes? And if they occur, are they called a hurricane? And is the rotation different? And how come the West Coast seems to be spared more so than the Atlantic? And I'll go ahead and listen off air. Thanks.
All right. Thanks very much for the call. Ed?
Yeah, well, as Jim alluded to, the hurricanes form over very warm water. So if waters continue to warm, that would suggest stronger, potentially stronger storms in the future. The water off the West Coast is quite cold. There's the California Current that flows from north to south along the west coast of the U.S., so that's not a good breeding ground for hurricanes and tropical systems. So it's quite rare for any of those type systems to impact the west coast of the U.S. Every once in a while, there will be a storm that will form farther south and turn northeastward, and as it's about to go extratropical, may go into Southern California and, of course, Arizona and some of the desert southwest areas on rare occasion. But the tropical systems usually just don't form there because the water's too cold. And they would be hurricanes there. That's another interesting question that I get sometimes, and that is that the same type of system has different names in different parts of the world. There are hurricanes in the Atlantic Ocean, the Caribbean, and Gulf of Mexico. Also in the eastern part of the Pacific Ocean, just off the west coast of the U.S., the storms are called typhoons once you get into the western Pacific Ocean, and they're called cyclones around the Indian Ocean and Australia, some of the South Pacific. And the term cyclone, it can generically be used for any low-pressure system, but the word cyclone is specifically used for the tropical systems, which we call hurricanes around here, over other parts of the world. So cyclone, typhoon, hurricane, when we're talking about tropical systems, they're all the same.
They are all the same. So there aren't any distinctions beyond the geography?
It's just the geography.
Okay. Let's go next to Doug in Spring Bay. Doug, good morning. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I understand Ed Keezer's here with us.
He is.
Certainly miss you, Ed.
Well, thanks.
Well, the comment is, how much longer are we going to be held hostage to people with an ideological interpretation or point of view in terms of the situation we find ourselves in? All the major scientists say that climate change is real, it's happening, it's man-made from carbon, and yet our politicians are dead in the water. They can't make a move. They can't even talk about it in the current campaign. Oil and gas industry is, saying drill, baby, drill. Our whole current energy future is looking at, the debate is, are we going to have a pipeline? Jim Hansen says if the pipeline is built, it's game over for the climate. And yet we continue down the same road. And so my question is, how many of these superstorms or droughts or heat waves are we going to have to keep on going with before we wake up and start to look at the handwriting on the wall? I'll get off and listen to your answer on the air. Thank you.
All right. Thanks very much for the call. Jim, anything you'd like to say about that? I mean, I know you may not want to get into the politics of it, but maybe talk a little bit about the science behind climate change and whether there is a correlation to make between more significant numbers or aggressiveness of storms.
Yeah, you really can't talk about policy issues, but at least the scientific side. Yeah, there's been quite a bit of study on this, obviously, for many years now. And there's some things that we're fairly certain of that are going to continue, and those are trends in things like the extreme rainfall events and probably the heat waves as well. There are some things that we're not quite as sure of. The frequency of drought, for example, that might be kind of a toss-up, especially in the central part of the U.S., where some of the models suggest we'll get wetter and some suggest we'll get drier. So we're not quite sure how that'll play out. So from a scientific standpoint, some of this is maybe still under debate in that respect. But I think overall, we have seen trends in the global temperatures increasing over time. So I think the overall concept is still there, and it's under the broader umbrella of climate change. But I think, pulling it back to the present, I think one of the things we can do is do a better job of preparing for the current climate events that we're seeing, the current extremes. So better planning and mitigation for things like droughts and floods and heat waves and flooding in New York City. Those kinds of things have immediate payoff. And the nice thing about those kinds of things is they're free of politics, in the sense I think everybody can agree on those. So I think that's one way to move forward on this whole issue.
Ed, anything you wanted to chime in on regarding this, or just pass?
Well, the politics is going to make it difficult to get anything done. And one thing I've noticed over the last decade or so, it seems the issue has become so polar on the political spectrum. And it really, I wish scientific discussions could take place without having to think about whether you're on one side of the political aisle or the other. That's frustrating to me a lot of times. And I live in a battleground state now, and I can tell you I'm not really encouraged right now, and it's just one commercial after another, and has been for the last 6 months or more. And there's a lot of toxicity in politics right now, so just even having a discussion is very difficult. So to answer the listener's question, I can't say when there might be discussions that are fruitful, where people come together and really talk about scientific issues versus political agendas.
Well, one thing I think that might be instructive is for the two of you to sort of describe what the difference is between climatology and meteorology. And so what roles you each play in understanding the weather around us. So I'll start with Jim.
Oh, okay.
What is climatology?
Yeah, that's one of those classic questions. It kind of boils down to what's the difference between weather and climate. And it's, kind of my working definition, there's maybe some formal ones out there, but kind of the working one is that the climatologist kind of looks at the longer-term picture, so looking at things over a season, over a number of years, decades, and even centuries and millennia. So we kind of look at the long-term picture in those respects. So we also look at different things that drive the weather conditions. So, Ed's worried more about, what's happening in the here and now, and we might be looking at, long-term trends in droughts or floods or rainfall events or ice cover in the Arctic Ocean and those kinds of things. So it's kind of what I use how to differentiate between those two. Is we just we're looking at the same thing. Don't get me wrong there, is that we're both looking at the same atmosphere, but just at different time lengths.
Is that basically it for you, Ed? Meteorology is short-term, climatology is long-term?
Well, the word meteorology actually is a broad term. It means the study of the atmosphere and its phenomena. And from there, you could say climatology is inside of that. Now, as a meteorologist, I do look more at the shorter term, making weather forecasts for the next few days to the next couple of weeks. And in the agricultural world, we try to look out a little farther at trends. Of course, the farther out in time you get, the less accurate the forecast. Now, I do also look at climate, but not so much in terms of researching where it might go in the future, but looking at past events and trying to put current weather into context with past events. I think it's always good to be able to convey where we are compared to what's happened in the past and what's typical and what isn't. And so I do look at climate issues, but certainly most weather forecasters, operational weather forecasters, are just looking at the next week or two into the future. And there are other people that are research climatologists that look into the decades and centuries into the future. So we actually just look at the same atmosphere just on completely different time and space scales.
We're talking about Superstorm Sandy with meteorologist Ed Kieser and state climatologist Jim Angel. We welcome you to the conversation at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL, or you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We'll take some more phone calls and emails. Also, we have some comments on our Facebook page we'll get to. That's all after a break. This is Focus.
As Gemma, the fierce old lady of the biker gang in the FX series Sons of Anarchy, Katie Sagal has shot and killed people, pulled a gun on a baby, and other horrible things.
She's done quite a few. What, you know, might be viewed as heinous, but she does not view them that way.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Katie Sagal. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the 4th Annual Champaign-Urbana Folk and Roots Festival, November 2nd and 3rd in downtown Urbana, with over 70 artists performing blues, jazz, old-time, Cajun, bluegrass, and Irish music. The festival also features storytelling, Saturday workshops, and family activities. Schedules and information at cufolkandroots.org.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. We're talking with meteorologist Ed Kieser and Illinois state climatologist Jim Angel about Superstorm Sandy, how it came to be, what conditions are required for a storm of such magnitude, and whether we're likely to deal with more storms of such magnitude in the future. We also welcome any observations you have about the storm and how, if in any way, it has impacted you and your loved ones in recent days. We welcome those comments and questions you may have, either meteorological or climatological in nature, about hurricanes and how they behave and how a storm like this one could have developed and wreaked such havoc as it made landfall, and what, if anything, we could learn from all of this. To join our conversation, call 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL, or you can email your question to will-talk@illinois.edu. We do have a couple of comments on Facebook. Steve writes that one of the key factors in this storm was the large blocking high over the North Atlantic, which helped turn Sandy westward to the East Coast. What is a blocking high, Ed?
Well, sometimes the atmosphere, looking at the jet stream, often it just has a kind of a gradual wavy west to east flow, but sometimes those waves get big, what we call meridional, because the winds start to blow along the lines of longitude or meridians, and that's a blocking pattern. It kind of looks like the Greek letter omega, so a lot of times we call it an omega block. And when that happens, the progression of west to east in the storm systems that move across the country just slow way down. And so that blocking ridge over the Atlantic helped keep that hurricane near the coast, and also had that low-pressure system coming in from the west slow way down, too. So that is part of the reason why the two systems came together, and part of the reason why, or a large part of the reason why, this whole system is slow to move out of the northeastern U.S.
Jim, we have a comment on our Facebook page, actually a question from Rebecca that gets back to what you were talking about before. Rebecca writes, I live in New York City, and in the last 3 years we have seen two blizzards, Tropical Storm Irene, and now Sandy. This level of severe weather has not occurred here for decades. Can we expect more frequent severe weather events in the next few years? And if so, what more can we do to prepare?
Oh, boy. Yeah, that's a tough question to answer. You know, even though we talk about climate change and long-term trends, that doesn't mean that year to year you're going to get a consistent trend one way or the other. I was thinking back in 2005, we had a very active hurricane season that year. In fact, we had a record number. I think it was like 33, 35 systems at that point in time. And but then, you know, the next couple of years after that, it actually calmed down a little bit. So there is this kind of lumpiness sometimes to these extreme events. So you kind of have to take the longer-term view on those. But I can say that it's, yeah, it'd be very hard to predict what's going to happen in the next couple of years. But, Well, you've certainly seen, you're in the Midwest, quite a bit of activity in the last 2 years in terms of extreme events as well. And, you know, we talk about climate change as being kind of changes in the average temperature or average precipitation, but it's really the extreme events that really have an impact on people. And so that's, I think we're in the future, that's where a lot of the research is going to be focused on now is what can we expect in changes in the extreme events. And that's a lot harder to get a handle on, but I think that's where the focus is going to be.
Let's go next to Paul in Champaign County. Good morning, Paul.
Hi there. Yeah, I just think that this is a disservice because the physics are pretty clear. More heat in the ocean, more moisture, more energy. There's been a reference to, well, studies do indicate, and I mean, studies are there, and they can't but be preliminary in some ways. But when the implications of the worst case scenario is, you know, a greenhouse effect like Venus, a trajectory that would take us to absolute destruction of the ecosystem, I'm not saying that's the case, but I'm just saying when that's in the error bar, the parameters, there's just got to be a little more urgency about this, it seems to me. You know, what, Romney, it's a bit, you know, I think you have to engage in the politics of it. When Romney lampoons the idea of the oceans rising, while there are people flooded out in Louisiana at the time, not to even mention the, you know, the scenes we're seeing now with just a foot raise in sea level or so over the last century. It just, you know, it's frustrating to not hear a little bit more, I'll say it, urgency about this. We got to confront this, and I'm not hearing it here.
Okay.
So that's why I wanted to interject. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. Well, I guess, Jim, again, the key point here is we have a couple of scientists on today talking about the science of weather and climate. And so, yes, there are lots of forums for the political discourse, but this would not be one of them today in this hour.
That's right.
Anything that you'd want to say based off of the listeners' comments, though? Any clarification or anything?
Well, yeah, you know, it's certainly that the impact of sea level rise and the warming of the oceans. I mean, there's even a whole other chapters of kind of impacts that go along with that as well. So yeah, it's certainly a major concern of scientists. I think, just kind of speaking personally, it's always you're in a tough spot because once you go from talking about science to moving over into the policy and politics issues, it can be very painful.
Okay. Let's next go to a listener in the Illinois town of Belgium. Good morning.
Good morning to you all. My question, or maybe observation would probably be a better way of putting it, is that in New Orleans, we're below sea level. In New York, subways are below sea level because they're underground and you're right there at sea level. It seems to me you would make provisions to solve that problem. In other words, why in the world wouldn't you put waterproof doors on the subway so the water doesn't get to the bottom? Sure, it's expensive, but one time like this saves a lot of money. Same way with Katrina in New Orleans. You build something below sea level, you're just asking for trouble when you locate it right beside the sea. It just seems to make common sense. The same thing is true in San Francisco. You built a city on top of a earthquake zone, you're looking for trouble. Now in California, they make all the buildings much stronger now and force them to build to a specification that's going to help alleviate some of the problems. Why not, when we build these cities and these houses and stuff right next to the water, you got to say, folks, you got to look at the obvious. You're going to have these problems. Start in the beginning.
All right. Thanks for the comments. Ed, I guess, again, I want to come back to what was unusual about this particular storm and the fact that it made a turn and moved so far up the East Coast. We haven't seen, a hurricane find its way to New York City in a while.
Well, actually, last year, Irene,
that's right,
the New York area. But we have not seen a storm, at least in my recollection, that has made a turn in so abruptly toward New Jersey. And what that did with the counterclockwise flow around the storm is bring a lot of the seawater into the New York harbor and lower Manhattan and also on out into the coastal areas, Coney Island on eastward there. So the storm surge was devastating for many communities because it's something that doesn't occur very often. And I think there is some complacency because it doesn't happen very often. But storms do on occasion plow into that part of the country. Comparing the forecast for this one to a storm that hit in 1938 when there was no warning and about 600 people lost their lives, we've done a lot better to prepare, at least in the near term, a few days in advance. But I still think in a lot of places, because the storms don't happen that often, folks just seem to think, well, it's business as usual. And these storms are certainly wake-up calls. And the other thing I'd like to note from the previous caller, how are we going to rebuild after this? The Jersey Shore is devastated. People are still going to want to go to the Jersey Shore, but perhaps it ought to be rebuilt in a little bit different way. The building's a little farther back from the ocean. Perhaps those things ought to be considered so that there will be some that will want to just rebuild it the way it used to be. But is that the wisest thing, especially with sea levels rising? So considering where we are in the near term as well as looking out in the longer term is important to try to make the best decisions going forward.
Jim, part of this is understanding that as the climate changes and we talk about different regions of the country and what we're used to in terms of, well, these are the kinds of severe weather threats that this region might face versus this region. You know, we think we're in Tornado Alley here. Well, maybe 200, 300 years from now, it's not Tornado Alley anymore. It may be something else. You know, the Southwest has always dealt with hurricanes. Well, maybe they'll deal, if the climate changes a little bit and adjusts a little bit, then different parts of the country are going to look and feel a little bit different in terms of weather, right?
Yeah, it's very possible that some of these events, especially the more extreme things, will change with time. And we kind of know that from past experience that there's times in the past where we've had for example, here in Illinois, if we've early part of the 20th century, we dealt a lot with drought. About between 1895 and 1965, we had about 8 statewide major droughts. Since then, we've only had 1988 and 2012.
Yeah, I was just going to say, good thing we don't have to worry about that anymore.
Yeah,
oh, boy.
Right, yeah. And so really, in recent years, we've probably had more problems with too much rain. Lots of flooding on the Mississippi and things like that. So that's,
well, you know, then that gets to perspective,
right?
Because you know, it's a natural tendency to think in the short term about whatever we're dealing with immediately. We've just been through an enormous drought here in the last year, so the idea that we've been in recent years, if you look over the longer term, dealing with more rain than usual, it sort of boggles the mind. Because you know, what you think about is, no, I'm thinking about the drought of the last several months.
That's right. And then if you add on top of that, a lot of these folks that are living on the coast right now, they're not, you know, these aren't multi-generation of coastal dwellers. You know, a lot of times, especially in Florida, you know, you got a lot of new-time first-timers moving down there, and they may never even have seen a hurricane up close before this or last year. So, you know, that kind of experience that the old timers might have is not carried over. So there's, and also it's always fascinating, you know, if you look at pictures from 50 years ago at some of these coastal areas. I mean, there's like, you know, a couple of fishing huts and maybe a sleepy little fishing town. And now you look at them, there's multi-million dollar condos and they build them right up to the edge of the beach. And so we've not done a very good job in that regard of taking into account the risk of living on the coastline.
We have about 5 minutes left. There is still time for your questions and comments. For meteorologist Ed Kieser and Illinois State climatologist Jim Angel, you can call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Ed, we have an email from Ian who says, years ago, a man on the Art Bell Show predicted that a blizzard with the intensity of a hurricane could come out of the north. Could this be true?
Oh, I guess I can't rule everything out, but coming straight out of the north, that's highly unlikely. Highly unlikely. Weather systems tend to move west to east. Occasionally, you'll get something to back in from the east when conditions are right. But to have a system come from due north like that, a blizzard out of the north, not likely.
I'm wondering if there could be any sort of storm, any sort of storm system, combination of systems, anything that could cause as much damage here in the Midwest that we've seen in the Mid-Atlantic and Eastern Seaboard in the last week.
Yeah, you know, we're talking off the air. Probably the only one I think of in recent years was just the the blizzard of 2 years ago, the Groundhog Day blizzard that really had a big impact on Chicago and a large system that moved through basically through Oklahoma, Missouri, Illinois, and then on to Michigan, on out to the East Coast. That one did produce quite a bit of snow, and you know, for a couple of days it really shut things down in the Chicago area. But that's a little different because, you know, the blizzard, it's here, and in a couple of days the snow melts or whatever, and it's gone. So the impacts are pretty short-lived. So to have something like this where the impacts are probably going to last, you know, it could be months or maybe even years before some of these areas fully recover from this event. So it's hard to think of something that large and that intense as far as the damage occurring in the Midwest at this point.
Ed, Jim mentions snow. We haven't really talked yet about West Virginia, which in the midst of all of this was really deluged with snow.
Yeah, well, not only West Virginia, but farther south there, too, down the spine of the Appalachians. I was looking at some snowfall totals here. 5 miles southeast of Gatlinburg, Tennessee, up in the mountains there, 34 inches of snow.
And wow.
That's actually, of the official reports, the highest one I've seen so far, 33 at 2 miles north-northwest of Clayton, West Virginia. But a lot of places did get, in the higher mountains, 2 to 3 feet of snow from the system. And that is something that's not unprecedented, but a bit unusual this early in the season. A lot of the snowfall was elevation-based. I had a coating of snow here in Columbus yesterday morning.
Really?
It snowed a little bit in the pre-dawn hours, so it was a bit white outside. And a place to the northwest, about 50 miles, called Bell Fountain Ridge, got 4 to 5 inches of snow in Ohio. So some of the snow did get this far to the west, and, of course, the strong winds farther west, all the way to Illinois and Wisconsin. So, yeah, snow is a big thing. I was thinking in the Midwest we'll never have a weather system that will have the impacts of a hurricane in terms of the storm surge flooding and the coastal destruction. Probably the biggest thing to hit the Midwest in terms of keeping some people in the dark for weeks would be a major outbreak of tornadoes. But, of course, tornadoes don't hit the entire area. They're kind of hit and miss. And also an ice storm in the wintertime. I think back to 1990, the Valentine's Day ice storm, and in Champaign-Urbana, many places were without power for a full week. So occasionally you'll get events like that, but as far as a weather event that's as widespread with significant damage, probably not.
Ed, Lisa has a question. She asks, were there any tornadoes associated with Sandy?
None that I know of. That doesn't mean there weren't any, but none that I know of. A lot of times there are tornadoes associated with hurricanes, but by the time this hurricane came on shore, the storm was already becoming extratropical, and it was a little bit cooler. And so no reports of tornadoes that I saw. So there might have been one that kind of flew under the radar there, but this storm was more about just the widespread winds. It was already losing its tropical characteristics as it was coming inland, and tornadoes usually spawn out of hurricanes in the spiral bands, the tropical spiral bands around hurricanes, and we didn't see quite as much of that with this system once it came on shore.
We have just a minute or two left. I want to try and get in one more call. Eric's in Urbana. Hi, Eric.
Hi. Ed, could you explain to me, you know offhand what the barometric pressure was of the Sandy, and I don't get this barometric pressure thing. It seems like when it's real low, the tendency for things to fly around is commensurate with the lower it goes.
Well, the lower the pressure, Jim mentioned this earlier in the show, the winds are caused by the differences in air pressure. So the lower the pressure gets in the center of the storm, that means the bigger difference between that low pressure and higher pressure, the center, which may be 1,000 miles away, but still that bigger pressure difference leads to much stronger winds. And You know, I don't have the exact lowest pressure. Jim, do you recall what it got down to? I know it was below 28 inches of mercury when it came on shore.
Yeah, somewhere in that ballpark. Yeah, I never saw the actual lowest of the low pressure, but it was pretty impressive on the weather maps. And that, you know, they draw these lines called isobars, which are lines of constant pressure, and there was a lot of those around this event. So it was a very large pressure gradient there.
Well, gentlemen, you know I would be happy to chat with you both all day long about this, but we are out of time. Jim Angel is the Illinois State Climatologist from the Illinois State Water Survey here on the campus of the University of Illinois. Jim, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
And meteorologist Ed Kieser, thank you for joining us as well.
Well, it was fun. The time went fast.
It sure did. My thanks again also to Kelly Formoso, volunteer and youth coordinator for the American Red Cross in Champaign. The Red Cross, of course, provides all sorts of information, and if you are interested in volunteering with them or there's some other things you might want to do with the Red Cross, you could go to redcross.org for information or call 1-800-RED-CROSS. We welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website, will.illinois.edu/focus. On tomorrow's show, we will discuss the social responsibility of engineers and scientists with Charles Ferguson, president of the Federation of American Scientists in Washington. He was to give a talk as part of the MillerCom lecture series on campus tomorrow, but he was among those who found himself stuck due to Superstorm Sandy, so that lecture is being rescheduled for this spring. Nevertheless, he will join us on air tomorrow, and we will welcome your questions and comments, again, about the social responsibility of engineers and scientists. That's on Thursday's show. Today's program was produced by Travis Stansel. Other members of our focus team are Pam Dempsey, Kimberly Cronick, and Jim Meadows. Kyle Mabry's our technical director. He handled your calls today. I'm Craig Cohen. Thanks for joining us.